It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. I should bring you warm greetings from Western Pennsylvania, since you need them on a day like this. My indebtedness to the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary is both professional and personal. Over the last several years, I've just finished about 500 pages on Galatians, writing about how neither the so-called dominant Protestant approach makes sense of the book, and why the so-called new perspectives on Paul also does not yet make sense of the book. Anyone who studies these issues in Paul cannot help but run across Mark Seifert's name and Tom Schreiner's name. They have helped me again and again as I tried to make sense of Paul over the last several years. Personally, I also am indebted to Matt Hall, who was a student at Grove City College not too long ago, and to two of my very good former students, Greg Wills and Sean Wright, who were students of mine at Gordon-Conwell a significant time ago. I won't embarrass them by indicating just how long ago it was, but I should mention that the president at the time was Abraham Lincoln. My lectures these several days are designed for two categories of people. Perhaps you will find yourself in the one category or the other. They're designed, on the one hand, for those who preach, and on the other hand, for those who listen to them. Perhaps at a theological seminary, some of you will find yourself in at least one, if not the other, of those conditions. My focus today will be on the 18th verse of the first chapter of 1 Corinthians, and the Lord willing, tomorrow it'll be the 21st verse of the same chapter. And so let me place those verses before us with a little bit of their context. I will begin in verse 14, 1 Corinthians 1, looking at verses 14 through 25, though we will focus mostly on verse 18, where Paul says that his message is foolish. And tomorrow we will look at verse 21, where he says the medium of proclamation is foolish. Beginning in verse 14, I give thanks to God that I did not baptize anyone except Crispus and Gaius, lest anyone might say that you were baptized in my name. I did indeed baptize the house of Stephen, but whether there were any others that I baptized, I do not know. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but rather to preach the good news, and not in a word of wisdom, lest the cross of Christ be empty. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to those who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of those who are wise, and I will abolish the understanding of those who understand. Where is the one who was wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has God not rendered foolish the wisdom of this world? Since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, God was pleased through the foolishness of preaching to save those who believe. For Jews seek signs and Greeks demand wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews, foolishness to Greeks. But to those who are called, whether Jew or Greek, Christ, the power of God, and Christ, the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger. Amen. I'd like to say a few things about our focal verse 18. Just a few things, three things I'd like to call your attention to make sure we get them squared away here. The word of the cross, what does he mean by that? Folly, what does he mean by folly? And why does he say to those who are perishing? All three of these, it seems to me, are essential to understanding the importance of what he says here. The context, before we look at those three, is good old-fashioned Corinthian divisiveness. right? I happen to be ordained in the Presbyterian Church in America. Dr. Ed Clown used to refer to us as the split peas because there were so many different EPC, OPC, PCA, right? We were the split peas. We didn't invent it. We learned it from the Corinthians. They taught us how to be divisive, and apparently we Presbyterians were good learners. The Corinthians here had even divided over the various ministers who had preached the gospel to them. They found some way to distinguish themselves from one another, even over a common faith in our crucified and risen Redeemer. They still found some way to be divided. And Paul, in a very rare statement, follows the verb, I thank God, with a negative. Almost always his thanksgiving sections. We thank God for this, I thank God for that. Here he says, I thank God that I didn't baptize, right? Had I baptized any large number of people, we'd have had another denomination. I was baptized by Paul group, right? I'm glad I didn't do that, he says, right? And in this context, he reminds us Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with words of eloquent wisdom, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. And then, in this context, he mentions the word of the cross. He says the word of the cross is folly, and that it is folly to those who are perishing. And note when he says the word of the cross is folly, this is very important, because unbelieving people do not regard all aspects of our faith to be equally crazy, right? Many unbelieving people will say in a general sense that they think Jesus was a very good person, a good moral teacher, and sometimes they will even say that the golden rule itself is a very fine piece of moral wisdom. But then when you start exploring the crucified Christ, the Christ crucified for sinners, they get a little antsy. They get unhappy. It's the word of the cross that people find to be folly. The crucifixion of an innocent man is difficult. And when I chat with my unbelieving friends from time to time, which I only do on their nickel, and I recommend that to you also, wait until they ask you. But when I chat with them, they'll talk about the problems they see in the church, and I say, that's great, but the apostles didn't tell us to believe in the church, did they? No. And then they'll talk about hypocritical Christians or unlovely Christians, and I say, great, but did the apostles ever say you had to believe in those? Right? So sometimes I'll say, but you've been around, you know. What does Christianity say that we're supposed to believe? And they say, well, probably that Christ died on the cross for sinners. Probably. They just don't want to get near it, right? And the reason they don't want to get near it, Paul says, is the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. Folly. My good friend and former colleague David Wells was lecturing at Westminster Seminary 2 weeks ago on March 13th. That's roughly 2 weeks ago. And David suggested that perhaps the best way to describe this word in our language is stupid. It's stupidity. It seems stupid to talk about an innocent man dying for others on a cross. Folly, in the original, is a stronger term than mere error. If I ask one of my Greek students at Grove City College, there's an irregular verb there in verse 6. What tense is it? And he says, I think it's an aorist tense. And I said, that's a good guess. You're wrong, but that's a good guess. It's irregular. It's a perfect, and it's a peculiar perfect that doesn't duplicate, and so it's a little awkward. But I don't accuse him of folly, do I? It's just an honest mistake, right? But the word of the cross to those who are perishing is not just mistaken, it's nuts. It's crazy, right? It's stupid. David's language, a little offensive to us, but I think David's language catches what Paul is saying, that it seems crazy to talk about someone dying on a cross. It is folly. The gospel always destroys the wisdom of the wise. It destroys the strength of the strong. Because it causes us and demands of us that we forsake all reliance in any human wisdom, any human power, or any human resource. The gospel destroys the wisdom of the wise, Paul says. The gospel tells us what Solomon had already told us when twice he said, there is a way that seems right to a man, and its end is the way of death. Right? There's a way that seems right, and its end, Solomon says, is the way of death. And the cross, therefore, challenges all of the surrogate so-called wisdoms of the unbelieving world. The contest between true wisdom and false, between human wisdom and divine, is not limited to our passage that we just looked at. It runs throughout the Corinthian correspondence, throughout this letter and the next. Without comments, let me just read a few of those to you. At the end of our chapter 1, verse 30, he is the source of your life in Christ Jesus, whom God made our wisdom and our righteousness and sanctification and redemption. The first verse of the next chapter, when I came to you, brothers, I did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom. The fourth verse of that chapter, my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and power, that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. The 13th verse of that chapter also, we impart this in words not taught by human wisdom. In chapter 3, verse 19, for the wisdom of this world is folly with God, for it is written, he catches the wise in all of their craftiness. Or in the second letter, in the first chapter, 12th verse, our boast is this, the testimony of our conscience, that we've behaved in this world with simplicity and godly sincerity, not by earthly wisdom, but by the grace of God, and supremely so toward you. And then in the second chapter of that, he says, the natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is not able to understand them because they are spiritually discerned. The word of the cross, a dying Redeemer, tells the world that its perilous situation cannot be repaired by any merely human activity. No human wisdom, no human power, no human insight, no human cleverness can rescue a mortal and rebellious people from their mortality and their rebellion. Had there been a less expensive solution to our problem, God would not have had to give up his only son. And that the repair was so expensive is a constant reminder to humans that in and of ourselves, we are as lost can possibly be. And this seems crazy, folly, and stupidity to self-assured, self-reliant people. They will never be able to embrace that message until they first forsake their own false wisdom. And then note then that this word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. I remind you of that because later in the passage, he specifies two different groups, right? The Jews who are seeking signs and the Greeks who demand wisdom. And we might think, therefore, that he says the gospel, the word of the cross, is only followed to Jews in the first century and Gentiles in the first century. But no, he says it's folly to those who are perishing, whether Jew or Gentile. The Jews and Gentiles were just examples of the broader category of those who are perishing. And those who are perishing in every generation, in every culture, will stumble over this remarkable word of the cross. It is folly to all who perish, not merely to Jews and Greeks. It is foolishness to be told people who have two perfectly good hands, two eyes, two ears, a nose, a mouth, none of it does you any good. Your hands don't feel as they ought to feel. They don't embrace what they ought to embrace. Your eyes do not see what they ought to see. Your ears do not hear what they ought to hear. Right. It is the message of our impotence outside of Christ that is folly to those who are perishing. The first week of January in 2004, I met Dr. Celebrezze down at Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh. It wasn't a very happy occasion in my case. They had discovered a tumor in my intestines. And as I met with Dr. Celebrezze for about 45 minutes with my wife, he explained 11 months of cancer treatment that I would have to look forward to. Had a stage 3 cancer, and I would surely die without the treatments, and probably die even with them, right? Probably die even with the treatments. And so then he laid out for me, of course, the chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, more chemotherapy, another surgery, and off we went. Interestingly, what he told me was this: what you have, you cannot fix. Right? You are in a very desperate situation, and there is not anything that you can do in your power to fix it. Right? And that's what the apostles and all who embrace their gospel say to a fallen world. You are utterly lost, and there is not anything in your power that can be done to remedy the situation. And people who are perishing say, well, that's just nuts. Show me the self-help manual, and I'll do it. Right? Give me the 5 easy steps, or, dare I say it, the 4 spiritual laws, and I'll fix it myself. Right? Right? I'll fix it myself. The gospel is always insulting. Those who are perishing will always object to it. Let me suggest several things to those of you who will either preach or listen to preachers. First, obviously from this text, the wisdom of those who are perishing will always be contrary to God's wisdom. Always. They will always be in conflict. You occasionally have a conversation, I occasionally have a conversation, that I call a blinker. I don't know if you call them blinkers or not. I call them blinkers. You're in a conversation with someone, and partway through the conversation, you realize that you are so far apart that there's really nothing else to be said, and you just kind of look at each other and your eyes blink. If you go to the Lutheran satire page, they do a very good job of representing blinkers. Some of the people that dialogue there end up just blinking. A couple of years ago, after I'd written Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns, a person saw me at a reception somewhere, and he said, do you mind if I ask you a question? I said, not at all. He said, why would anyone write a book on why people cannot sing hymns? And I looked at him and said, why would anyone write on anything else? And we just blinked. Because for me, the one part of our earthly worship that will survive into eternity is the singing of God's praise. We will not need the sacraments of baptism to admit people into the body of Christ when the number of His people are full. We will not need the Lord's Supper to commune with Christ because He will be there. We will be at the marriage feast of the Lamb. We will not need preachers to tell us about truth when God Himself will be our light. But we will need tongues. Oh, for 1,000 of them to sing our great Redeemer's praise. The most heavenly aspect of our earthly worship is the singing of God's praise. And so the question is not why someone would write about it. The question is why would anyone write about anything else? At which point we merely blinked, right? And that's the way the believing world and the unbelieving world react. At some point we simply blink at one another, because everything we say about a Christ dying on a cross just seems like crazy talk to them, and it will always be that way. And if those of you who are preparing for the ministry find yourself 10 years into it, or 15 years in it, or 20 years, and discouraged because some people think what you're saying is crazy, this doesn't prove that you're failing, it proves that you're succeeding. What you're saying is crazy to those who are perishing, and you shouldn't be concerned they find it that way. Let me say a second thing about what I think Paul is doing with the gospel here in the Word of the Cross. The Word of the Cross is never additive. The Word of the Cross does not come into your present life and add something. It is also subtractive because it is transformative. We put off the old man in order to put on the new. And it is this that makes it so offensive, because the Word of the Cross says we aren't going to add to your perfectly orderly life something else. It says your life is not at all ordered. It is not well ordered in the least. He who loves mother or father more than me is not worthy of me. That sounds like craziness, doesn't it? It sounds crazy. He who would gain his life must lose it. Why, that sounds crazy, right? It sounds crazy. All former wisdom, all former allegiance, all former values, they have to go. All the vain things that charmed me most, I sacrificed them to his blood. All. And the unbelieving world finds this to be just crazy. Absolutely crazy. And because of this, my third comment for those of you who might preach or listen to them is this. For these very reasons, we cannot market the gospel. We cannot market the gospel. Almost all marketing says this. You're okay. Your life's pretty cool. Your values are good values. Your appetites ought to be sated. Your allegiances are good. You just need a little bit of this, our product, on top of it, right? Think of the language of the geniuses who market. You deserve a break today. Have it your way. Christianity doesn't say any such thing. It never says that. It says, in effect, that you and I are not okay at all. Our desires, our wishes, our appetites, our aspirations, our anxieties, our fears, our hopes, almost all of them are entirely wrong. And they have to be forsaken. They have to be forsaken. Our values and priorities are upside down, topsy-turvy. We have worshipped and served the created thing rather than the creator who is blessed forever. Completely upside down. And so the church cannot market itself the way other things do. Because what we have to say again and again and again, while saying it about ourselves and others, that we have sinned daily in thought, word, and deed, and there is no health in us. And only the dying and rising Son of God can solve the problem we have. And that remarkably crazy, remarkably stupid, remarkably foolish message will always seem that way to those who are perishing, until by the grace of God's good Spirit, the same thing happens to them that has happened to you and has happened to me. We have come to love that very offensive, non-flattering message. We've come to love the Christ who's dying and rising is all that our sin needs. And now what was once foolish appears wiser than all wisdom. And what once appeared weak is now stronger than all strength. But in between, when those two different categories hear it, they only blink at one another when they hear that message. And if you are a faithful minister of the Word of the Cross, sometimes when you preach your best sermon, the only reaction you'll get is blinking. And you have not failed. You have not been unfaithful to your task. You have not been unfaithful to the gospel. You have just preached that gospel to perishing people who will always regard it as crazy. And when they do, ask them if you can pray for them, that the message that they currently find to be crazy will one day appear to make perfectly good sense. And you'd be surprised that your unbelieving friends like mine will sometimes say, well, please do pray for me, so that the Christ that brings you comfort could bring me comfort also. And so we will do. The word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to those who are being saved, it is the power and the wisdom of God.